This is BBC Radio 3. It's just gone 1 minute past eight. And now the Sunday feature, Byzantium. Professor Judith Herrin travels to Istanbul to chart the long history and legacy of the Byzantine Empire.
Here in the Hippodrome, or circus arena, which preserves the precise form of a racetrack, I'm in the very heart of the old city of Constantinople and the centre of modern tourism in Istanbul today, where once the chariots raced around the track. Large coaches now deliver parties of tourists who come to view the Hippodrome and the Blue Mosque, which is to the south side. Originally, of course, there would have been tiers and tiers of seats on either side, plenty of room for the people of Constantinople, senators on their marble benches, the emperor who could enter the imperial box and overlook the Hippodrome from the imperial palace, and probably wooden seats above for the rest of the population. Byzantium was a medieval empire that lasted for over 1,000 years, from the 4th to the 15th centuries AD, and yet we know so little about it. Its legacy lives on in many ways, but it must be said that the empire has had a very bad press. We associate it particularly with those negative stereotypes of a deceitful, cunning, duplicitous, labyrinthine and complex organization. This use of the adjective Byzantine derives from Enlightenment scholars and philosophers like Voltaire and Gibbon, who had no time for Byzantium. They saw in it a weak state dominated by scheming eunuchs and overambitious empresses, worthless monks who frittered away their time on the Bosphorus. This is because the Enlightenment was interested in asserting Europe's claims to the Greek classical past, to the Greco-Roman world of Mediterranean civilization that preceded the world of Christianity. They wanted to assert that Europe drew its strength from the Greek city-state and the Roman Empire and the great achievements that they wanted to set at the base of European civilization. They had no time for Byzantium. Against those negative stereotypes, we can set some more positive images. For example, today people are beginning to appreciate Byzantine art, particularly its icons, its monuments, its churches, and most importantly, we can draw attention to its historic role as the bastion of Greek Christianity in the East, which withstood the armies of Islam for centuries. From the beginning of the Islamic expansion in the 7th century AD, Constantinople was the prize. The forces of Islam wanted to capture Constantinople to make it their capital, from which they would advance into Europe, through the Balkans and Central Europe, to expand the world of Islam. And for centuries, they were checked at Constantinople. Without Constantinople and its historic role in resisting the forces of Islam, Western Europe could not have developed in the way that it did. Without Constantinople, Europe is inconceivable. The name Istanbul is a corruption of the Greek Istinpolin, to the city, because for centuries Constantinople was simply known as the city. It was the greatest, largest, richest city in the medieval world. Constantinople, Istanbul, is on the European side of the Bosphorus, this great gulf between Europe and Asia. This is also the gulf that links the Black Sea to the Aegean and the Mediterranean Sea. Constantinople was the magnet for merchants from all over the medieval world. Its harbours and its markets brought together those from the north, from Russia, the south, from Arabia, from east and west. Even in its modern Turkish transformation, the Byzantine spirit is clearly present in the cosmopolitan mix of peoples, languages, trade, and tourism. Constantine had been looking for a new site which would be nearer his major enemy, Persia. And in 324, he settled on the little site of Byzantion, which had been founded by colonists from central Greece, and he decided to make it a new capital, which he named after himself, but which he also called New Rome. And in this name, we can understand there was both an echo and a challenge to the old Rome on the Tiber. Because as the Roman Empire in the West declined and fell, the Roman Empire in the East, now centered on its new capital at Constantinople, prospered and flourished. Constantine the Great came to this point in 330 AD to inaugurate the Hippodrome, a great celebration which was held on May the 11th, and this gave the new population a sense that they were inhabitants of a capital city with all the features of a Roman imperial capital. They continued to call themselves Roman until the end of the Byzantine Empire, and they felt themselves to be part of that Roman tradition which Constantine had inaugurated. All that remains today are three monuments on the central barrier that divides the two sides of the track. A stone column constructed by Constantine the 7th in the 10th century, the serpent column of three snakes entwined, which was a victory monument put up by the Greeks after a great victory at Plataea in Delphi in central Greece, and a stone obelisk from Egypt, which Constantine brought to Constantinople, which was a necessary feature of all Roman cities. For me, the obelisk embodies several components of Byzantine civilization and culture, which enabled it to survive and resist and endure for so long. These are the great forces of the ancient world, the ancient pagan tradition of the Greek, and even further back, the world of Egypt, the Roman world of administration, law, technical ability, administrative skills, building an empire, and of course the Christian faith. Byzantium created a coherent fusion of these three component parts, which permitted it to survive, to flourish, and endure for such an extraordinarily long time. I think this is, if you like, an inner Greek fire which gave the inhabitants of Byzantium the confidence and the resilience to survive for so many centuries. In AD 532, the circus groups who organized the racing, who were known by their colors, the greens and the blues, mounted a challenge to the emperor Justinian by electing a rival emperor. Justinian and his wife Theodora were inside the palace and could hear the rioters shouting their victory slogan, "Nika, Nika, we shall conquer." In the course of their discussions, Theodora is said to have stepped forward and said, "My lord, there is the harbour, here are the boats, you may flee. For myself, I prefer this imperial purple as my winding sheet. I would rather die wearing the imperial purple. Let no one ever not call me empress." And at this stage, Justinian was encouraged to send in the troops and put down the riot by force, and it seems that many innocent people and unarmed people were killed, but nonetheless he reasserted his authority. Not before the rioters had set fire to a large area of central Constantinople and had burned down the original Church of Holy Wisdom, Hagia Sophia, built in the 4th century. Justinian then decided to clear a very large area of the centre of the city so that he could rebuild it according to his own plan, and his immediate ambition was to build the most magnificent church that anyone had ever dreamt of. under the enormous dome erected by Justinian's engineers in the 6th century AD, we can begin to appreciate the ambition of this emperor. Nobody had ever tried to raise such a huge dome, in circumference wider than anything that had ever been built, and higher than anything that had ever been built. And the construction techniques are still not entirely clear to us, nor were they at all clear to contemporaries who felt that the dome floated in the air as if suspended over this vast expanse below. It must have been a most extraordinary place in which to worship. This was the largest church ever built until Michelangelo built the Church of St. Peter's in the Vatican. By the 6th century AD, Christianity had become very well established, and the Emperor Justinian was quite determined to remove all traces of pagan veneration, of the cults of the ancient gods, of superstitious practices associated with the ancient world. He also had a great ambition to remove heresy. And in the Fifth Universal Council held in Constantinople in 553, he tried to encourage the bishops of the Christian world to come to a more uniform definition of Christianity. This proved as unsuccessful as most universal councils, but it did set a benchmark. It didn't succeed in removing all the varieties and variations in Christianity, but the Hagia Sophia Church, in a way, represents that desire to impose one empire, one belief, one Christianity, one ruler, a unity of church and state, exemplified in the moment when the emperor goes to the main west door and is greeted by the patriarch, who is the bishop of Constantinople. They kiss and they enter together to celebrate the liturgy.
It's obvious that that church has a vision of a church that is the church of the empire.
Maria Vasilaki is professor of Byzantine art at the University of Volos in Greece and a great expert on Byzantine icons.
Even if one enters the church without any level of knowledge of what that monument, what that church meant to the empire, gets a feeling which is quite strange because, you know, the building is talking, is trying to tell you its history. I mean, that takes you back to the first emperors of Byzantium. Hagia Sophia started as a church erected by the founder of Constantinople, Constantine the Great, and even though his building did not survive, he was the one who decided that it was important to set up a church in that part of the town, which is very central, is next to the imperial palace. But it was Justinian the Great that gave the church the form that still keeps to this day, a huge building with a huge dome. And all this light that is coming through the windows is reaching you while you're entering the church. You have all this light on you, upon you. What Justinian had in mind was to have an exceptional building with a decoration that would shine in one way, but in another would not include any figural representation. Obviously, he had a cross in the coach of the apse, but no figures. We have to go to later centuries to find the gradual introduction of figural representations into the church. And of course, we have to come to the later centuries to find unique mosaics like the Desis, and which means this monument kept an up-to-date conversation with the emperors till the last day of Byzantium, there was something to add there.
After the Emperor Justinian, all subsequent rulers further enriched the city with new Christian buildings and strengthened its fortifications, sometimes using stone from the pagan structures which fell into disrepair. They particularly repaired the triple line of defences constructed in the 5th century, which were the land walls from the Sea of Marmara to the Black Sea. Such investment was essential, since from its earliest days, hostile forces coveted the commanding position and accumulated wealth of the eastern capital. From Goths in the 4th century to Persians, Avars, Slavs, and Arabs in the 7th, Constantinople was frequently besieged. In their extraordinarily brilliant campaigns of the 640s, the Arabs had overrun and conquered most of the East Mediterranean and the Persian Empire. The prosperous Roman provinces of Syria, Palestine, and Egypt were conquered, depriving Constantinople of large resources of manpower and taxation, including the grain fleet and much of its wine supply. From Damascus, the Arabs continued to press on against Byzantium, harassing the coastlands as well as the interior of Asia Minor. They conquered the whole of North Africa. In the east, they crossed the river Oxus and moved into Uzbekistan, which of course remains Muslim to this day. In 717, the Arab navy sailed into the Sea of Marmara, while two land armies sent out from Damascus encamped outside the walls of the capital and prepared to starve it into surrender. The newly enthroned emperor, Leo III, was an experienced military commander who called on his allies to attack the besiegers in the rear, while he made strategic use of Greek fire to destroy enemy ships. This was a substance which the Byzantines kept as an imperial secret. It must have been made of a sort of heavy oil, like a napalm, which could be combined with some lime to make a combustible liquid that could be projected from siphons on ships against the enemy. It burned on contact with water and destroyed enemy ships by fire. Fortunately for Byzantium, the winter of 717 was also very harsh, and the Muslims suffered terribly from the cold. By midsummer of 718, the caliph ordered the siege to be lifted, and during their retreat, the Arabs suffered storms in the Aegean, which destroyed their navy. The Arab challenge, however, was not exhausted. In the period from 719, after the siege, to 740, their attacks continued unabated. An indirect consequence of these Arab challenges was a tremendous upheaval within Byzantium directed towards the images of holy persons, icons of Christ, of the Mother of God, saints, bishops, or monks. As continual Muslim victories over the Christian forces of Byzantium dominated the first half of the 8th century, churchmen and civilians alike questioned why the Byzantine forces were not more successful. Why was it that God had abandoned them? They knew that God always granted victory. Why did God not grant victory to the Christians? Instead, it was the Muslims who were winning. Eventually, they concluded that the Christians must be committing some very grave sin. And the emperor's advisers informed Leo III that it was the sin of idolatry, excessive worship of Christian images, that was causing divine displeasure. So in 730, Leo issued an order to remove the holy images, thus opening a period of iconoclasm, the destruction of icons, which dominated the empire until 787 and again from 815 to 843. Similar acts of image destruction had occurred earlier in Armenia and in parts of the Near East, where some mosaics of living beings and animals were carefully replaced by decorative trees and floral representation. The key to Byzantine iconoclasm in the 8th century, however, must lie with the example of Islam, which admitted no figural representation in full compliance with the second commandment of the law of Moses, "Thou shalt make no graven images." Of course, many people refused to comply with the order to remove their icons. In particular, monks and women appear to have found the veneration of religious images of holy persons very important to their faith and their private worship. Monks were often icon painters as well as writers of manuscripts which were illustrated with religious images. Women were excluded from serious roles in the church hierarchy of priests, and so may have found greater satisfaction in directing their prayers to icons. Whether or not there is a more general association between female worship and icon veneration, it is striking that two widowed empresses were in control of the empire when the order of 730 was reversed. In 787, Empress Irene, with her young son Constantine, presided over the Council of Nicaea, which restored the icons. And again in 843, Theodora, widow of the Emperor Theophilos, repeated the process through the creation of a new liturgy which condemned iconoclasm and brought back the veneration of icons. These women in purple wore the costume of the emperor and ruled almost as if they were men to ensure that Byzantine religious art could return to the patterns established before 730. Scholars dispute both the causes of iconoclasm and its results. But the veneration of holy persons that was re-established in 843 produced the great flowering of Byzantine art which we associate with the great traditions of Byzantium, Maria Vasilaki.
The triumph of Orthodoxy is the triumph of icons. So figural representation was banned, but in the end it was the icon itself that came to represent the figural representation. So in one medium, everything was incorporated. So after 843, one can say that icons returned to the church and took the most dominant place there. It's obvious that from that time onwards, the Templon will start creating space for icons. Soon after, we'll have processional icons, icons that will be carried around the church or outside the church. And so from that time onwards, one can say that there is nothing else to be associated with a society and a culture and a faith more clearly than icons themselves. There they are to take the role they had to play. And they will keep this role, I mean, and that's interesting, to this day.
A major doctrinal consequence of iconoclasm was the separation of Old Rome from New Rome. The bishops of Rome separated themselves definitively from the patriarchs of Constantinople because in Rome they never accepted the policy of iconoclasm. And from the mid-8th century onwards, Old Rome went its own way in Western Christendom and left the Orthodox Christians to pursue their own definitions of theology.
In an Orthodox church, icons are still playing a vital role for the church ritual, for the everyday visits of faithful to churches. I mean, Orthodox Christians are still venerating icons, they're kissing icons, they're kneeling in front of icons, and icons are still taken around in processions. So this is a tradition that lives to this day.
In addition to the great upheavals over artistic traditions during iconoclasm, new imperial structures were developed, which facilitated the reconquest of territory in the Balkans and in the East, and brought about the conversion of the Bulgars and the Russians to Orthodox Christianity. Byzantium's economic fortunes also revived in the 10th century. At Constantinople's main commercial harbour, recent excavations for the new Istanbul metro system have revealed a large number of wrecked ships, which had all been blown up against the harbour walls and sunk. Over 33 shipwrecks of different types and dates have been identified with their cargoes, And from these amazing finds, archaeologists think they will be able to rewrite the history of Byzantine shipbuilding from the 7th to the 12th century, as well as the history of everyday life in Byzantium. The wrecks confirm that Constantinople was a constant trading hub that continued to attract merchants from Arab, Russian, Slavic, and Western regions. Muslim military activity remained a regular threat to Byzantium, and in the late 11th century provoked one of the most momentous developments in medieval history. In response to their capture of the Christian holy places, Pope Urban II preached for a crusading movement of Christians, Western and Eastern, to march against the infidel. Although Byzantine emperors had made alliances with Venetian, Genoese, and Pisan merchants, who were familiar figures in the empire's ports, the arrival in Constantinople of large numbers of pilgrims and mounted knights from northern Europe caused many anxieties. The Western Christians didn't worship in the same language or in the same way as the Orthodox. They used unleavened bread in the sacrament and a different wording of the creed. Cooperation between Catholic and Byzantine Christians rapidly gave way to mutual distrust. Tensions culminated in 1202 when the Fourth Crusade was diverted from its original destination and Constantinople was sacked by the Crusaders. 1204 was a turning point in Byzantium's history which defined its particular character and divided it from the West forever. Loot from the city now adorns numerous Western cathedral treasuries, particularly the Church of San Marco in Venice, where four antique bronze horses brought from the Hippodrome were placed on its façade. During the Crusader occupation of the city, from 1204 to 1261, churches were distributed to Western monks and vast regions of the empire were occupied by the Latins. Several Byzantine centres of resistance developed at Nicaea in Asia Minor, Trebizond on the Black Sea, and in Epirus, Western Greece. A remarkable resilience of the imperial ideal, with courts that attracted scholars, artists, and administrators, encouraged these mini-empires. And in 1261, the navy of the Nicaean Empire discovered that Latin Constantinople was unprotected and managed to recapture the city. There was a joyful return to the real capital, which remained the hub of Byzantium for the next 200 years. During the 14th and 15th centuries, the Ottoman Turks revived Muslim determination to conquer Constantinople, and Byzantine rulers found it harder and harder to perform the historic role of their predecessors. In 1354, the Ottoman Turks crossed the Dardanelles at Gallipoli and began the conquest of Thrace. Soon they controlled both the eastern and western approaches to the capital and were able to throw a military cordon around it. Byzantium made increasingly desperate appeals for military help from the west, but successive bishops of Rome demanded that Christian support for the beleaguered city must be dependent on the reunion of churches. Since this policy was strenuously resisted by many Byzantine ecclesiastical leaders, as well as ordinary people, there seemed to be no hope of resisting Ottoman sieges successfully. The unexpected arrival of the Mongols under Tamerlane and his defeat of the Ottoman Sultan Bayezid in 1402 provided a welcome respite for Emperor Manuel II, who was then in London trying to raise money to finance a stronger defence of his capital. Although Henry IV of England and Charles VI of France both promised support, Manuel never received any, and at his death in 1425, the situation of Constantinople was again very serious. His son, John VIII, could see that the only way to obtain any military force from the west was to negotiate a union of the churches, which he did at the Council of Ferrara, Florence, between 1439 and 1440. But the crusading force of Hungarian and Western knights sent to relieve the city was crushed at Varna 4 years later. It was here that Constantinople finally fell to the Ottoman Turks in 1453. I'm standing within the 5th century walls, in one of the inner towers in these massive triple line of defences built by the Emperor Theodosius. During the final siege of Constantinople, a vast Ottoman force of 80 to 100,000 men, supported by the largest cannon ever cast, fought against a mixed force of fewer than 7,000. Venetian, Genoese and other Western forces, the remaining Byzantine troops and local inhabitants. From the 6th of April 1453 to the middle of May, there was fierce resistance, which almost persuaded Sultan Mehmed II to withdraw. But on the 29th of May, his forces were finally successful. The night before, Emperor Constantine XI, the last ruler of Byzantium, addressed his troops and reminded them that they were the descendants of ancient Greeks and Romans, and he encouraged them to fight against the infidel. But on that day, the Ottomans breached the walls at this point at the Romanos Gate, which is now Topkapi. It was the weakest point in the defences and had been manned vigorously by the Genoese condottieri Giustiniani. Constantine died in the fighting that day, and it is believed that his body was taken up into these very walls, where it is preserved, and he will come again to lead his people. This hardly seems likely, but on the other hand, it explains why no body was ever found, although the Sultan insisted on them bringing a body, which they said was the Emperor's, so that he could put the head on a spike and parade it around the city. Byzantium lived on despite the events of 1453. The actual name Byzantium was coined by 16th century Renaissance scholars to describe the civilization of Constantinople, at a time when its influence on Western art and scholarship had become obvious. Maria Vasilaki has written extensively on this aspect of Byzantium's cultural heritage.
If we see some panels painted by Italian artists, it's obvious that they had seen Byzantine icons, and they were struck by the Virgin. They were struck by representations of Christ as the Man of Sorrows, just to mention one example. And they were also struck by processional icons, which were double-sided. And instead of painting double-sided panels that would be completely out of context, let's say, in their culture, they painted diptychs. And so what you find on both sides of an icon, you find it in Italian diptychs. If Constantinople had survived, I'm sure that many of the things that we saw happening in the West would have happened in Byzantium itself, but it could not. What Byzantium itself could not experience, it was made possible in Venetian Crete, because Venetian Crete kept its Byzantine tradition and at the same time was under the Venetians, which means they were able to communicate with their Italian colleagues. And so the circumstances were ready to develop, first of all, painters who had an identity, who had a social status. We don't know how far that went in Byzantium itself. In Crete, it went as far as to create the case of Dominikos Theotokopoulos, that is El Greco, which means he had a very good Byzantine background. It's obvious that he was trained as a Byzantine painter. And then, living in Venetian Candia, could see works of art, could be influenced by those works. And then later on, he felt like going to Venice to see a Titian, to see a Tintoretto with his own eyes, and then to be able to work with them, as it happened in the end, before he took all the way to Spain. That was his basic language, one would say. I mean, that's the language he learned to speak, first of all, as an artist. And he never left it. His Byzantine tradition was very important for him. I mean, for example, the fact that he continued till the last day to sign his works in Greek means that he really wanted to underline his Byzantine tradition.
The legacy of Byzantium is also evident throughout Central and Eastern Europe and across the Balkans and Russia, where Orthodox belief was spread by medieval missionaries and icons. In due course, the Russian Tsars also claimed the inheritance of imperial power, while the Patriarch of Moscow tried to become the leader of all Orthodox churches, hotly disputed to this day by the Patriarch of Constantinople. With the fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman Turks, Christianity lost its last foothold in the East Mediterranean. The Byzantines became part of the Muslim world, their new rulers neglected its Christian past, and the call to prayer replaced the tolling of Christian bells. I talked about this neglect to John Freely, who's lived in Istanbul since 1960 and has written many books about it, including Strolling Through Istanbul and Istanbul, the Imperial City.
Byzantium gets left out of Western histories, it really does. And of course, there is a tendency in modern Turkey now for people to emphasize, and of course, when you see the city, you see all the minarets, but you don't quite know that some of those minarets are coming up from places like Hagia Sophia that were Byzantine churches. So unless you really specifically know about Byzantium, you'd have to discover it on your own to know that the Byzantine city is still here. The interesting thing that maybe you don't know, not living here, is that the tremendous resurgence in interest in Byzantium on the academic level by young people who are not the elite in Turkey, but I know the son of a carpenter and the son of a day laborer who are now doing Byzantine archaeology. There is that sort of grassroots interest in Byzantium which is springing up without any pressure from the outside at all. It's extraordinary, yeah.
That would be a real change in Turkey, wouldn't it? Because it seems to me that the Turkish state and the official hierarchy has a great difficulty dealing with this Christian past.
But everything that we're seeing here now, living in the city rather than looking from the outside, is incredible things are happening in Turkey despite the state and despite the attitudes and despite nationalism. And so it's absolutely amazing. Turkey is... It really is discovering what it is now on a national level in this astonishing way that isn't hitting the press at all. Turkey's been cut off from the outside for so very long, and suddenly it's opening up, and they're terribly curious about the outside world. And so they've heard about Byzantium in their courses, and they get the usual story and so on, but they're interested in finding out more. This incredible curiosity that was so circumscribed before is now not anymore. It's quite open, so they'll take the natural course that young, curious people will do. But they have access now to universities, and I mean, our maid's two children have graduated from university. Every taxi driver I take over the age of 40 has got children going to university. So Byzantium is one thing that a lot of people are interested in because it's right here in front of them. Oh, not only here, but all over Anatolia as well. And they're very curious about who came before them.
Perhaps because Byzantium has no direct heir, many cultures and states insist on their descent from medieval Constantinople. This claim is naturally upheld by Greece, the country with an immediate linguistic link back to Byzantium as well as to the ancient world. It's also highly developed in Armenia, Georgia, Russia, and other countries where Orthodoxy is the dominant form of Christianity. And Byzantium is at last being claimed by the Turks. This is a big historical and political shift for Turkey, as Nevra Necipolu, professor of Byzantine history at Bosphorus Boğaziçi University, explains.
I have been teaching at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul since 1990. And when I first started to teach in the history department as a Byzantinist, I encountered some problems at the time because there were some people at least who thought that the study of the Byzantine Empire was not an appropriate subject and that at least it should not be named, as the courses should not carry the name Byzantine Empire. So one reason is, of course, the problem of the required languages. Ancient Greek, especially, is not a language that is easy to learn in Turkey or Latin. As a matter of fact, the study of classical languages or classics departments has not been a well-established part of Turkey's educational past. As far as Byzantine studies go, it has a relatively short history. We can go back to the 1940s, when at Istanbul University, for the first time, Sir Stephen Runciman had been invited to give lectures on Byzantium. So for the beginning, there were no native Turks to do that. A second very important reason is, of course, the ideological problem, because until recently, let's say, for many Turkish people, the Byzantine civilization and the Byzantine past is not considered to be part of their own cultural heritage. And so Byzantine history is sort of regarded as part of the Greek past and not really part of the Turkish past. While I was a graduate student studying Byzantine history, people used to ask me, why are you not studying Turkish history? And I'd say, well, this is part of our cultural heritage as well, and it should be studied and learned and encouraged in Turkey.
Murat Belge is one of the leading intellectuals of Istanbul and author of many books on Ottoman civilization, Turkish literature, and contemporary politics.
Westerners throughout Ottoman histories made us feel that we were living on lands that did not belong to us, that belonged by right to Christendom. And, of course, this got in under the skin of people. Memories last long and behavior is not always activated by rational motivations. If there are too many Byzantine signs around, they have the feeling that this will encourage people to say, well, who are these people? Why are they here? We are living in a more rational age than we used to, and I don't think it really makes sense to carry on with these fears all this time. But at the moment, when I look around me, I'm not too pessimistic. At the same time, I cannot be too optimistic. I mean, to get interested in whatever we can talk about, there has to be some channel from that object to your mind. And when these channels are blocked because of all these prejudices, offensive or defensive or whatever, then of course you cannot arouse interest. When you don't know, you don't love. You can love what you know, you can only hate what you don't know. So these channels should be open. It's not the case that, you know, Turkish people are not interested or they dislike Byzantine history. It's just that they are not informed and there is not enough excitement to get them interested about it. And so this information is taking time, of course. There are surprising continuities. Surprising, you never think about them, but when you by some chance get to learn, for instance, that backgammon comes from Byzantine times. This is something. And then, of course, the whole administrative know-how. There really is a lot inherited from Byzantine tradition into Ottoman. And I would even go so far as to first ask a question. Who is the true follower of Byzantium, Greeks or Turks? And then give the answer, well, in many ways, the Turks. Even the way we articulated the religious branch in the state apparatus was directly taken from the Byzantine tradition. So in those areas, we are the true children of Byzantium, and then the poor Greeks in Attica and Peloponnesus had nothing to do with all this know-how.